we turn to your word, I pray, Lord, that our ears will be open. I pray, Lord, that what is of you will stay in hearts and minds, and anything that's not will be forgotten. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, so we're going to look at Ecclesiastes. And I know it's not a very popular book for some people. It's quite a difficult book. It doesn't have endearing, lovable characters that we can get to know. It doesn't have a nice storyline we can follow. The discussions and the arguments, they're a bit all over the place. They don't follow a nice straight path. They're a bit higgledy-piggledy. It goes off here, there, and everywhere. But the writer asks many questions. And to be honest, I think he says about as much about what we don't know as what we do know. I must admit, I got halfway through this and I did think, I wish I'd picked Ephesians or the armour of God or some nice blessing. It would have been a lot easier. But you know what? The book of Ecclesiastes is worth sticking with. It's worth wrestling with. It addresses some major life issues with a refreshing bluntness, a refreshing honesty. And whilst the teaching might be a bit unconventional in its style, it does make us think really hard about some really important issues. There are questions. What's the point of life? What do we gain from all our work and toil and strife? Can true value be found in this life? How should I spend my time on earth? Well, Ecclesiastes introduces us to a wise man who sought to give these questions a reply, to try and answer some of these things. And the reality is we live in a broken world today, just as he did in that time. And actually the questions that he asks and the meaning that he sought, so many people today are seeking. They're asking those questions. Our young people are wanting to know, what's the point? So to understand the book, we kind of need to realise that during Ecclesiastes, we hear from two voices, the preacher and the author. The preacher, he's the main voice of the book. He's the one we hear most of. But he's introduced to us by a character called the author. That's how we refer to him, as the author. And he's collected the words of the preacher. He introduces him. And then at the end of the book, he summarizes. And it's actually the author that gets the final word. Now, we're not actually given the name of the preacher's name. But from the description of himself and from various experiences that he recalls, it's inferred that it was King Solomon. If you look, the very first line, get back to Ecclesiastes. There we go. So the very first verse of Ecclesiastes, the words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. In fact, in verse 12, the preacher refers to himself, I, the teacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. And we haven't got time to go through it all, but for now, there's a lot of evidence within the book to support that, and we're going to make that assumption that it was King Solomon. And if we think of him as being this wise man, he began his reign as a humble servant of God. He sought God's wisdom. He wanted God's help. He genuinely loved God and he had a heart for God. He sought after God's own heart. He asked for wisdom so he could govern the people wisely. And God gave him wisdom. We all know the wisdom of Solomon. It's a phrase. The book of Proverbs. Even today in the secular world, so many phrases, mottos come from the book of Proverbs, the wisdom of Solomon. He was greatly blessed. For Israel, Solomon's reign was an age of prosperity. His riches was great. His wisdom was renowned. His influence in terms of politics actually extended right across the Middle East. No king of Israel was as great or as blessed as Solomon. But as he grew older, his heart turned away from Jehovah. He turned his face towards some of the false gods of the many wives that he'd brought in from foreign countries, different nations. Now, ultimately, God confronted and chastised Solomon about this, about his unfaithfulness. No amount of money or authority or power could stop divine judgment. In Solomon's later days, they were rather miserable, really, because God removed his hand of blessing. And the only reason he maintained the throne at all was a promise that had been made to David. So this is the man that we believe is speaking in this book. A man at the end of his life, and he's looking back on his experiences. He's looking back on what he's learned, what he's known. Now, if you've ever read Ecclesiastes, it's a bit of a jumble of miscellaneous, I suppose, ideas. There's a variety of topics. It's thrown in. It's quite chaotic in some ways. It's hard to kind of keep track of. And it's a bit like life today. Life today is chaotic and hard to keep track of. But going back to that first verse, the word that is used for teacher, or in some Bibles it says preacher, the word that's actually used there is koheleth. And it's a Hebrew word, and it was used for an orator, someone speaking in front of an assembled group of people. But it was more than that. It carried the idea that debate. And it wasn't debating with the assembled people, but it was debating almost with oneself. So it was the idea of presenting a topic, looking at it, discussing it, looking at it from different viewpoints, and then coming to a conclusion. And this is very much what the book of Ecclesiastes is. And in fact, thinking about it in a kind of scientific way helps us to understand the book. The man who we called the preacher, if we think that he spent his life conducting experiment after experiment to try and supply a hypothesis, trying to supply an answer to the question of what's the point, what's the meaning. But in all of his experiments, there was one consistent thing that he applied. He applied a restriction. And that limitation went throughout all his experiments. He would only look for answers under the sun. Now, in Ecclesiastes, that phrase, under the sun, is used 29 times. A couple of times there's the phrase, under heaven. But he very much was looking at things of this earth, the physical, the things here and now. In all his tests, his evaluations, he basically took God out of the equation. He was applying his wisdom, his experience to some really complex situations, and he was trying to, you know, make sense of it all from a human perspective. Now, to me, that really resonates with here and now in 2023. You know, this society is called a post-Christian society. Culture, society as a whole, has removed God. In schools, trying to speak of God in schools is getting harder. In so many areas of life, God has been removed. So as he looks around for answers, the preacher finds that things are vain, the answers are absurd, things are impossible, he can't define the answers. So by verse 2, he's already kind of making a statement and reaching a conclusion. And again, there's different translations. This one here says, meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless, everything is meaningless. We have another translation which says, vanity of vanities, everything is vanity. Some translations, if we go back to the Hebrew word that's used is hevel. And neither meaningless or vanity and vanities really explains what hevel is capturing. Hevel means smoke, vapour, fleeting. Whatever disappears quickly and leaves nothing behind, doesn't satisfy, is hevel. H-E-V-E-L. Smoke, maybe think of it, it can be beautiful. It can be mysterious. It can take one shape and then suddenly it can take another shape. You might think it looks solid, but if you try to reach for smoke, your fingers just pass straight through it. But sometimes smoke can be like a thick fog. If you're engulfed in thick smoke, it makes it impossible to see clearly. And this is the sentiment that is posed when we read these statements, vanities of vanities, or meaningless. It's hevel. So in the first few verses, he paints a picture really of the monotony of life. He lists streams flow, the sun rises, the sun sets, wind, it blows north, it blows east, the wind goes back and forth, the sun goes up and down, generation come, generations go. Time marches on. But he notes that the earth has been here a long time, and the earth will be here a long time after we are. The people who have already been are forgotten. The people who are to come, they'll forget us. And the people who come after them will forget them. We are in this earth for a fleeting amount of time. Now, we can read further and we realise that Ecclesiastes, it's almost autobiographical. The preacher has spent some time getting knowledge. He's gleaned wisdom. He spent time, he's learning. That's gave him knowledge. His intellect surpassed everybody else around him. But the more answers he had, the more questions he had, and the more sorrow he came to know. We read in chapter 1, I'm going to read verses 16 to 18. I said to myself, look, I have increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before me. I have experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. I've applied myself to the understanding of wisdom, but also of madness and of folly. But I've learned that this is like chasing after the wind. For with much wisdom comes much sorrow. More knowledge, the more grief. He wasn't finding any satisfaction in wisdom. So when knowledge and wisdom couldn't provide the answers he was looking for, he turned to something else, and he turned to stuff that was much more tangible. And he started looking for things that gave him pleasure. And we see through the beginning of chapter 2. We see the things then that he begins to accumulate, because he thinks, oh, these things now, I'll get pleasure from this. So he gets like houses, gardens, he's got sheep, he's got herds, he's got flocks, he's got gold, he's got silver, he's got slaves, he's got wives, all these things. And he tries to find the point and the meaning in things that appeal to him. In chapter 2, verses 10 and 11, I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my labour, and this was the reward of all my toil. Yet, when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what my toil had achieved, everything was hevel. It was a chasing after the wind. You can chase after the wind as long as you like. You're never going to catch it. So then he thought, right, now maybe I'll find contentment in doing work itself. So then he gave himself over to labour, enjoying it and doing it well. Now, I do like to look at Hebrew. I'm not a Hebrew scholar by any means, but there are 11 different words for labour. And the one that's used here is amal, A-M-A-L. And it actually means to toil to the point of exhaustion, yet experience little or no satisfaction. How many people have we known? Well, I've known number who toil and toil. They exhaust themselves, working, working, working. That's the main last thing of their life. Get, work, work, work. And they're not happy, they're not satisfied. He realized that no matter what he made, no matter what he was able to make of himself, death would come and death would take it all. And it would all go to someone else. We look at chapter 2, verses 18 and 19. I hated all the things I had toiled under the sun for, because I must leave them to one who comes after me. And who knows whether that person will be wise or foolish. Yet they will have control over all the fruit of my toil. I've poured effort and skill all under the sun. This too is meaningless. There was a professor of English at Columbia University in the 1940s, 1950s, and he was called Joseph Woodcratch, and he made this statement. There is no reason to suppose that a man's life has any more meaning than the life of the humblest insect that crawls from one annihilation to the other. Brilliant man, professor. How sad. I can see you laughing there. Our professor in the room there. So, we have a preacher who's looked back on his life to try and find something that he could pass on regarding everything that he's learned. And what we end up with is a record that's rather bleak. It's a bleak reflection on his experiments. And at one point he says, his advice after all of this reflection is, well, do you know what? Enjoy your food, enjoy your wine, enjoy your work, because then you're going to die. That's the wisdom that he finds under the sun, under the heavens. And I suppose it's true, because what the preacher, he's not saying that life has no meaning. What he's saying is that the meaning's never clear. It's like smoke. Life is confusing. It's disorientating. It's uncontrollable. You can't control what happens to you. Now, going back to the author, the author's basic goal seems to be to highlight the ways in which we try to build meaning and purpose in our lives. And then he's letting the preacher totally deconstruct that. The author thinks we spend most of our time investing energy and emotion into things that ultimately have no lasting meaning or significance, and he's letting the preacher deliver the hard lesson in reality in that quite blunt, harsh way. And if we continue to look through the book, and you'll be glad to know I'm not doing the whole of Ecclesiastes because I want my Sunday dinner as well. But it is a book, I would say, you know, persevere with, go through, look, because there is some gems, there's some pearls, there's wisdom in it. But you can become rather disheartened as you look through it. Near at the end, it said, death is the great equalizer. It renders meaningless most of our daily activities. It devours the wise and the fool, the rich and the poor. And I want to turn right to the end, because in chapter 12, the author, basically, he does a little conclusion, and I'm not going to read it all, but I'm going to read the last few verses. Not only was the preacher wise, but he also imparted knowledge to the people. He pondered and searched out and set out many proverbs. The teacher searched to find just the right words, and he wrote what was upright and true. The words of the wise are like goals. They're collected sayings like firmly embedded nails given by one shepherd. But be warned, my son, of anything in addition to them. Of making many books, there is no end, and much study wearies the body. Now, as well as being heard, here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the duty of all mankind. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing which is good or evil. So that's it. The wisdom, we're all going to get judged. So do your best, follow God's commandments. There you go. It's quite depressing, really. But in many ways, everything we've looked at is still relevant now, as I alluded to earlier. You know, life is random, it's unpredictable, it's chaotic. Just as you get one thing sorted, I get something sorted in my head, I think, I've got that now. Yes, I got it, I understand it. Or I make a plan and I think, right, yeah, I've planned this out, this is how it's going to go. Then something happens and everything gets turned upside down. You know, I kind of had this sermon half written yesterday, and then I went to the ladies' conference, and then there were some things that were said, and I was like, And I kind of came back and ended up rewriting it. This morning, everything was planned. Me and Tracy had chatted, like, Josh is away, bit of a pressure. Everything was planned, everything was sorted. We came down, projector wouldn't work. I had to get the ladders out. It was not what had been planned. Things come, things happen. You can't control life. We can't control what happens to us. We look around the world. We look at the news. We look at situations of people that we dearly love. And we wonder, what? I don't understand why. This makes no sense. So in all of this, is there hope? If there is hope, where do we find hope? And this is what's brilliant. Because the preacher he was writing back in the Old Testament, we are in 2023. And yes, we have hope because we've got Jesus. And Jesus changes everything. Let's go back to the preacher's word, right? Because he does turn our attention at points from things that are purely under the sun. And he does give glimpses of pointing to what's above in the heavens. If we go to chapter 3 and verse, where is it? Oh, I've lost my page. So chapter 3, I'm finding it. I had a little marker on it and now it's gone. Oh, here it is, right. Chapter 3, verse 11. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the human heart. Yet no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end. You see, we are not the same as insects. When that professor, as brilliant as he was, said, oh, our life's as meaningless as an insect, we are not the same as insects. We are human. We are unique. We are created by God, and God has put eternity in our hearts. In the human soul, there's this God-given awareness that there's something more to life. There's more to experience than just the here and now. Seasons come, seasons go. Things go on. We go through life, opposite experiences, the good, the bad, sad, pleasure. We get a glimpse of something. We get a glimpse of stability. And we reach for it, and then, whoop, it's gone, leaving us dissatisfied. It is only God who makes everything beautiful in its time. If we are without God, we can never be satisfied because we're always seeking for something more that only God can fill. Now, it says there about everything beautiful in its time. See, God is in control of time, and his timing was perfect when it came to satisfying the yearning. In Galatians 4. Galatians 4, verse 4. We read, "But when the set time had fully come, God sent his son, born of a woman." God's timing is important. He sent Jesus. But even Jesus, in human form, was governed by God's timing. Jesus resisted the pressure to reveal himself by saying repeatedly, "No, my hour has not yet come. My hour has not yet come." But then, prior to the crucifixion, he says, "My hour has finally come." Jesus' actions, with God's timing, they were perfectly, perfectly synced at the cross. So when Jesus died, in the fullness of time, perfectly synced with God's eternal plans, he placed eternity. He gave us the gift of eternity. That yearning that God has placed in us at creation, at our birth, the yearning we were born with. God on the cross gave us what we need to fulfill that yearning. But eternal life is just one of God's gifts. The preacher says, "Knowledge is pointless." But Jesus says, "Knowledge in him is a treasure." The preacher says our desires cannot be fulfilled. Jesus said he is our ultimate pleasure. Jesus says the rich are never satisfied. The preacher says the rich are never satisfied. But Jesus says his provision is all in all. The preacher says our toil is in vain. Jesus says our work in him will last forever. The preacher tried to prove that the questions were unanswerable. But Jesus is the answer. Now, if that's not a message that the people of 2023 need to hear, I really don't know what is. We have a world that is seeking, that is questioning, that is wondering what is going on. And we've got the answer. More than that, though, Josh has been looking recently at some of the I am sayings. And Jesus says, he is the way, the truth, and the life. And for us here who have been on the road a while and know him, we've got to always be guarded. We've always got to keep something in mind and always re-evaluate. Because it's as we give Jesus ownership of our lives, as we submit to God's will, as we align or get in sync with God's timing, that we get this satisfaction. Life won't be easy. There'll still be seasons. There's still good times, bad times. There's hard times. There's painful times. There's joy. We are not going to understand the reasons behind many of the things that happen around us, to us, the things we see. We're not going to be able to fathom. But it's as we walk in step with Jesus, we can then give things over to him. And I'm nearly done, but just a couple of more verses. Matthew 11, 28. "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Romans 8, verses 28. "And we know that all things God works for the good of those who love him." And it's nice to quote, we know all things work together for the good of God. But we forget there's that bit there of those that love him. And I was reminded yesterday of the importance that there needs to be action on our part. And there was this brilliant analogy that I'm going to nick because it was a kid, I think a schoolboy had written it in a book or something, but they shared it yesterday. And just imagine a circle, and that's your life. And, you know, you're in the middle of your life. And then you meet Jesus, and you ask Jesus into your life, and he comes into the circle. But we need to go deeper than that. We need to go further than that. Because, as again has been alluded to over recent weeks, we can still hold on to things and not fully give to Jesus. Jesus has to be in the center, on the throne. He has to have complete ownership of our lives, holding nothing back. So there's the two challenges that I'm going to leave you with this morning. One, we've got a message that the world needs to know. Can we be brave? Can we be courageous? Can we tell the world our message? But also, just take time and take stock. Is Jesus still actually at the centre? Have you given him all? Is he actually ruling over all aspects of your life? Thank you. Keris, we're just going to close with a final song.